Welcome to Afternoon Light, the podcast at the Robert Menzies Institute, hosted by Georgina Downer. The beep of the Soviet satellite Sputnik orbiting the Earth became part of the soundtrack of the Cold War. The Soviet Union's successful launch of the first satellite into space shattered the image of the United States as the world's technological superpower, and it spurred on the space race. In the area of education, however, another race took hold. Soviet high school students were graduating, in the words of US President Eisenhower, with 5 years of physics, 4 years of chemistry, 1 year of astronomy, 5 years of biology, 10 years of mathematics through trigonometry, and 5 years of a foreign language. The United States and Australia took note, and an education revolution was the result. Joining me to discuss the Menzies government's support for science education in Australia in the wake of Sputnik is Professor Jennifer Clark of the University of Adelaide.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's great to have you on the podcast. Goodness, I was searching that beeping noise, and despite not having grown up in that era, it certainly did make you think of all those sort of Cold War images and the sort of spookiness and the fear, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Tell me about what was happening in 1957.
Well, when Sputnik went over America and went over the territory of America, it sent panic throughout the nation. People were really, really worried because even though the journey was only for such a short time, it was around about an hour thereabouts, very short time, people didn't know what Sputnik could do. And they thought if it was possible for the Russians to send over this beeping bauble, then what else could they send over? And of course, they immediately began to think of missiles or war or defense issues. So it produced a lot of fear. And in fact, you could go further and say it produced panic.
What about in Australia? Were Australians panic-stricken about this? I mean, there was a very funny, I think, article in the Australian Women's Weekly calling it the new moon, and Newsweek said it was an eerie moon. So we were obviously captured by this moment, weren't we, as a nation?
Oh, yes. It was very interesting and people were absorbed by it. It was part of the whole space age. And of course, you get a lot of things on television in this era and going into the 60s as well, all about space, all about space travel, all about sort of extraterrestrial concerns. Even vacuum cleaners were designed to look like UFOs. So it was a very much a space age sort of era. But the difference between the Australian response and the American response was this issue of panic. Mm. Australians tended not to panic. It was more interesting. It was more a sense of the future. It was more that they were on the cusp of something new. And certainly there was a lot of talk about it being a new moon and something very unusual in that respect. But we didn't have the panic that existed in America. And I think primarily it was because in America, they quickly associated Sputnik and the fact that it traveled over the American territory with the issue around defense and national security. And we just didn't think of it in those same terms. And I think also because the competition in the Cold War was largely between America and the Soviet Union. And certainly we were Cold War players, but in that sense on the periphery a little. And so that competition meant that for the Americans it was a much bigger deal.
It's quite reminiscent of, I think it was last year or the year before, the Chinese weather balloon that went over the United States and then in the end got shot down. That sort of sense, what is that in the sky? And, oh, the Chinese are spying on us. The same sort of sentiments presumably were unfolding.
I think it's absolutely the same. And people were very worried. And then, of course, they began to look at their own systems and their own education processes, their own defense, their own national security. And the idea in America was that America came up wanting. while Americans were really interested in consumer products and buying cars and buying refrigerators and the sort of household consumer life of the 1950s, the Russians were out there studying physics and chemistry and being much more serious about academic work. And the result of that was a Sputnik that could travel over America.
Yes. I mean, just that Eisenhower speech with the reference to what a Soviet student would end up with, it's just incredible. And again, it feeds into sort of contemporary debates about how in Australia, for example, kids are falling behind their counterparts in other nations who do end up with masses more qualifications at the end of their VCE or SACE or whatever it is, year 12 in Australia. We seem to still be confronting that same sense of a problem that in a liberal democracy, the educational attainments might not be what you could achieve in an autocracy.
I think the same arguments are there now and people are concerned about the same things. And I think it's this notion of academic rigour and attainment, as you say. So I think there are a lot of parallels actually between the situation at the moment and concerns people have, and these concerns that were picked up in the late 50s, early 60s.
So tell me about the US administration's response to this, and in particular, I guess, in the area of education. So the president is Eisenhower, and there had been debates, hadn't there, as there are in Australia, around federal intervention into education, which is seen as the domain of the states. And of course, in America, in the US, there's a lot of like an allergic reaction to the state, to the federal government getting in the way of people's lives in general, but in interfering into the affairs of each of the individual states. So how did the Eisenhower administration react to this development?
Well, it's interesting because Eisenhower immediately came out and began to speak once they saw that Sputnik had created such concern within America. It wasn't that America didn't know that Sputnik was being developed. They were aware of the advances in science and technology in the Soviet Union. They knew that there was capability, but I think they were unprepared for the public response. And so Eisenhower wanted to remain calm. In fact, he continued golfing. And people were a bit concerned about that when they were looking at the potential of being attacked by the Soviet Union. There's Eisenhower out golfing.
Was he trying to portray a sense of calm, though? I mean, it's okay, US public,
yes,
I can still go and play golf. We've got this all under control.
He was very much sanguine about it, and he did not believe that America was necessarily behind. This was a matter of perception. But you've got people like Governor Williams in Michigan, and he said, "Oh, little Sputnik flying high with made in Moscow beep. You tell the world it's a commie sky and Uncle Sam's asleep. You say on fairway and on rough, the Kremlin knows it all. We hope our golfer knows enough to get us on the ball." There's this notion of Eisenhower playing golf while the Soviet Union is putting Sputnik into the sky. But Eisenhower was aware of what was going on, and there had been developments previously. He had understood that science education was important. They'd made inroads into developing increased interest in science education, but he had to come out in November 1957, which was roughly a month or so after Sputnik, and drew education into the national political story. And he did say that Soviet graduates were coming out in greater numbers, and it was clear now that they were also coming out with quality. I think previously the Americans had thought, well, even if they have greater numbers of Soviet science graduates, they're not going to be as good. Well, clearly they were as good because they could put up Sputnik before the Americans could put up an equivalent. And so in the State of Union Address in January 1958, Eisenhower also had to talk about this and make it clear that the Soviet Union was waging a sort of total war, because the Soviets were now talking about economic development, military power, and science and linking them all together. So what Eisenhower did was he immediately appointed James Killian, who was the president of MIT, appointed him as a science advisor. So he immediately got someone close on board, and then they began to rebuild science advisory committees and to look carefully at what they needed to do. And within a very short time, of course, they put through the National Defence Education Act of 1958. And this act was a way of the federal government providing support for science education. And you're right, most things in America that are not listed within the federal constitution as being federal responsibilities set within the states. And education was a state-based thing. But this act, this 1958 act, and you can see by the title, National Defence Education Act, links national defence, which is a federal responsibility, with education. And it was clearly trying to intensify interest in education, to provide a greater amount of centralised funding, to prioritise maths and science, and to prioritise academic excellence. And I think these two things should be considered together, because not only did they need more science graduates, they had a chronic shortage of mathematicians in America at the time. All the mathematicians were going into jobs in industry, but they weren't going into academic jobs to increase more graduates in science and math. So they had a shortage of mathematicians, and they did not support high achieving students in the way that they should have. And so this idea of the pursuit of excellence linked with science and technology were important in this whole story. So this is what Eisenhower did, tried to remain calm, but a bit like a duck, the feet were moving under the water and there were moves afoot to increase support for science and technology within America.
This National Defence Education Act, though, Jennifer, what did it actually provide? I mean, you identified all the problems they had in incentives to support higher achieving students, creating more maths graduates. But what was it actually doing in order to rectify these problems that James Killian had identified?
It provided money for engineering, maths, science, to encourage students to go into teaching, to get that cycle working of teachers of science and maths back in the schools. The other interesting thing it did, it provided money for foreign language, which I find actually really interesting, because you immediately think, oh yes, physics, chemistry, maths, foreign language. So that was also part of the funding. They also funded around area studies, so Latin American studies, American studies, so a little bit more on the social science humanities side. But the other interesting thing was that it recognised gifted students as an undervalued resource. So they tried to identify gifted students and to encourage them into science. So the funding was really around supporting science education and high achievement in the schools.
And was it primarily directed to schools and school students, or to universities and university students, or was it a mix of both?
Primarily directed towards school students and getting students to come through into the universities. And this pipeline is something that was identified very quickly in Australia. There was an interest in providing support for higher education, but they didn't have the students coming through from the schools with what we would see now as prerequisites for successful study at the higher education level. And partly the problem there was we did not have strong science teaching in the schools in the 1950s and early 60s. You had schools without science laboratories. You had schools without science teachers. When science was taught, it was often taught by people who didn't have any qualifications in science at all. They'd be taught by PE teachers or English teachers or whatever the case may be. Didn't have scientific equipment, definitely didn't have modern scientific equipment. And the interesting thing also, and this I'm talking about Australia here, when you did have science and you did have some sort of science equipment and laboratories, it wasn't in girls' schools. So there was not this sense that girls would do science. You would be training future men of science. And so if girls in girls' schools did science at all, they would do biology. So if they did biology and then they went to university and wanted to do a science degree and were then faced with having to do maths and physics and chemistry, it was very, very difficult. So that was a whole group that wasn't part of the process of getting higher level science in the universities. The girls were locked out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it still remains a problem. There are lots of programs to get girls interested in STEM and STEM careers. So those kind of gender stereotypes around science and maths with us to this day in 2024, aren't they? Can you tell me, Jennifer, though, why was it that our curriculum and infrastructure in schools was so poor at the sciences? I mean, was this just a feature of the British system that we had inherited? Was it because of things like the Depression and the wars that had just distracted us from focusing on investing in those things?
When you did have science laboratories or equipment in schools, it was often just really, really old. So you would have schools that had equipment just after World War One and had never been replaced. And there were no science laboratories at all. And partly this is to do with the curriculum. So there was not a sense that the curriculum had to have a practical component. So you've got a situation, I think, where a number of things are happening at once. You've got a traditional curriculum that is looking at the humanities and maybe even the classics. You've got a science infrastructure that is old and worn out and not been replaced. You've got war and depression in between. And you've got a period where there's no sense of leadership. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated. By the time you get change in the late 1950s and early 60s in Australia, you've got clear leadership that operates on a number of different levels. So, for example, you've got Harold Wyndham in New South Wales who brings in a new curriculum. And in that curriculum, he's Director of Education in New South Wales. In that curriculum, he says that students in high school should have 4 years of general science and then they should have 2 years of specialty science. So he adds an extra year to schooling in the late
90s. For every child, not just children every who child. Have a particular interest in the science. Right, yeah.
Every child was to have 4 years. That would take children up to our understanding, year 10, and then children could leave at year 10. And the idea was that those last 2 years would be particularly geared towards university entrance. Wyndham believed that about 15% of students had the capacity to successfully undertake university study. And so the idea would be that most students would leave after what we would see now as year 10, and that they would go and take apprenticeships, go into work, take jobs of various kinds, and some 15% or so would go on to further study. And in that further study, then they would do specialised science. They'd do the physics and the chemistry, biology and the higher level maths. So in terms of leadership and change, you've got dramatic curriculum change. Then you've got people like Harry Messel, Professor Harry Messel at the School of Physics, University of Sydney, who, when he's getting students come into physics, he sees that they are poorly prepared, can't do the work because they haven't had the school-based instruction. So he decides to move more into preparing the students at school so that he gets better students coming into Physics 1, right? So what does he do? Well, he writes the textbook to support Wyndham's curriculum, the massive tome that is the science book that a generation of kids grew up with. So he and a group, he put together a group of some 30 writers to write this textbook really quickly, put it out. So you've got that. Then what else does Harry Messel do? He decides to provide professional training for teachers. So he brings a whole pile of teachers into the School of Physics. He gives them a 2-week sort of professional development instruction. And he decides then that he needs to go beyond the teachers. He's got to go to the students. So he introduces then the summer science schools, which were running 50 years later and are probably still running, I think, to this day. So he would get in high-achieving students from schools. He would bring them to the University of Sydney. They would get a series of lectures. They would get the up-to-date knowledge that he believed they needed to extend them. So this is where we go back to this idea of the high-achieving student and find them and encourage them with science. So he does that.
And, Jennifer, was he picking up on ideas coming out of the United States, or was he developing this program himself? I mean, it seems quite extraordinary that a professor at the University of Sydney himself is driving all these initiatives. This wasn't top-down at all. There wasn't dictates from the New South Wales Department of Education.
No. This is Harry Methel, who's an absolutely extraordinary man, only recently died in his 90s. But an extraordinary man. He's Canadian, and he comes to the University of Sydney as professor of physics in 1952, and he's basically appalled at what he sees, and he goes about trying to fix the situation. But this is what I'm saying about leadership. You've got Harold Wyndham and curriculum change. You've got Harry Messel, who pushes for these changes, and then you've got Robson, who was a ex-principal of Sydney Grammar, and he takes a trip to Britain in the mid-50s, and he sees there a scheme whereby business and industry supports the development and building of science laboratories in schools. And he thinks this is a good idea. So he comes back to Australia and he brings on board a number of businessmen and industry people who also think it's a good idea, and they begin to raise money to build science laboratories. Now, we've discussed already that part of the problem is you don't have the equipment and the facilities in schools to support modern science teaching. And so they raise hundreds of thousands of pounds at the time and build laboratories. But the interesting thing about this is, and perhaps because of their background, they target private boys' schools.
Yeah.
So the reason they do this is that the schools have to have a co-payment, and so they think that the private schools would have the money to do that. And, of course, they're still thinking along these lines of men of science, so they target the boys' schools. But they're building laboratories. You've got curriculum leadership. You've got sort of professional and extra development and high-achieving leadership, and you've got infrastructure leadership. So if we look at that, we think, what's missing in the leadership? Well, it's legislation.
Yeah.
And that's where Menzies comes in.
It's political leadership. Because what that's you've identified was leadership from the state government bureaucracy in New South Wales, leadership from a higher education institution, and then leadership from an independent school's principal. So
that's right.
They were all obviously very inspirational people. They're all
on the one path.
But let's be honest, it's that overarching government leadership that presumably gives it some ballast to roll it out on a more national scale. Tell me, when did the Menzies government and Robert Menzies, I guess in particular, start to see the need to really focus on science education and build it up? When was it Sputnik? Was he influenced by Eisenhower at all, or was he developing these ideas himself or through the influence of some of these leaders that you've explained?
Menzies was like Eisenhower in the sense that he was completely calm about Sputnik.
Yeah.
And he understood that scientific achievement was something that you're going to find anywhere. And in fact said he would have been very surprised if the Russians had not done well in science and technology, that no particular nation had a monopoly on scientific achievement. And so he was quite sanguine about it and quite calm. But he was asked in Parliament after Sputnik, what are you going to do about this? There's Sputnik. What's your answer? What are you doing? And his response was, I'm working on it. And, of course, he was right because he'd been working on it for quite a long time. Menzies created the National Security Resources Board in 1950. He chaired that. And one of the recommendations of that board was to create a committee on scientific manpower resources.
Right.
And so that was chaired by
50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was chaired by Ian Clunies Ross from CSIRO. And the idea was that they would identify researchers whose work might be useful for defence. So this is what was happening in America as well, this link between science education, science research and defence. So Menzies was already moving down that path. And then, in fact, by 1956, he commissions Sir Keith Murray to lead a review into Australian universities, which is tabled in Parliament in September 1957, slightly before Sputnik goes over on the 4th of October 1957. So the timing is really interesting. So when Menzies is asked, what are you doing about Sputnik? His answer, I'm working on it, is absolutely true, because there is the Murray Report, which advocates for provision of extra scientific equipment, better recognition of science and science education, and if you want better university graduates in science, then you've also got to do something about getting better students coming out of the schools in science. So you can see then how the Murray Report, what Messel is doing, what Windham is doing, what Robson is doing, all fit together. And here you have Menzies, who knows about all of this, and in fact, in communication with Robson, and Robson invites Menzies on several occasions to open the science labs that he has built, and Menzies does that. So they're on the platform together. So they all know what everybody is doing. And Menzies is very much aware of the need for science education. But like Eisenhower, he's calm about it. And he's working on science education in a number of different ways. And I think the Murray Report is probably at this point crucial. But so is the fact that he's just aware of what other people are doing and he likes what they're doing.
But why did it take, Jennifer, until 1963 for Menzies really to act? I mean, we didn't see the States Grant Science Laboratories and Training Act, for example, till 1964. So he gets the Murray Report, yes, and says that it's, you know, high time we met the Soviet Union on our own ground and side by side with military preparation, made the positive case for free institutions, and he wants to make sure that our students are free to choose what to study. We are investing in these scientific pursuits. But we don't see a legislative response. And in fact, he doesn't seem to be talking about it much other than in very vague terms, for example, in his election speech of 1961.
Yes, I think this is a really interesting question. And I'm not sure there's an easy answer, but I think there are a number of things feeding into it. And one of the things is that Menzies was a humanist. Let's be frank here. He liked the humanities, he liked the classics, he liked literature, and he did not necessarily believe that that should be thrown out with a totally obsessive pursuit of science. And in fact, he said, if we produce more science graduates, has anyone given any thought to what they're going to actually do? So he wondered where this was going to go. So on the one hand, I think we've got this sense of Menzies as a humanist. And in fact, he admitted he didn't have a lot of personal interest in science. He wasn't actually that good at it. But he knew that it was important for the nation to pursue science and to do better in science education. So his heart was in the humanities, but his brain knew that we needed science. So I think we understand that. I think then you've got to look at what else is happening. And we've talked about the curriculum development and the professional development and the building. So he knows that other people are doing things and he sees that that's coming along. And then you get to 1963, which is a very interesting year in terms of the election of 1963. And here we get a number of things that muddy the waters, so to speak. And I think a lot of people see the 1963 election as an election for state aid. Now, part of the problem here is that he's seen to call a snap election. And in fact, We know Menzies is very politically astute. And so it would not be beyond belief that he would read the political landscape and identify the correct time to call that election and to act on it. And of course, what's fueling this that we haven't talked about much, this whole notion of state aid.
Yes.
So the funding of schools that are not government schools, and most of these private schools in the late 50s, early 60s, they're Catholic schools. And they are not eligible for any sort of government support and, of course, are not supported by the state government. But in 1962, you get the Goulburn strike. Now, this is when St. Bridget's Primary School has trouble with their plumbing and the government health regulations say that the Catholics have to put in more toilets, otherwise the school does not meet health regulations. Well, the Catholic diocese decides that they don't have enough money to upgrade their plumbing. So they close the school for 6 weeks and all of the children have to go to public schools in the Goulburn area. Well, of course, there's about six or so Catholic schools in that area, some thousand so children, and the state government schools just can't fit those extra children in, and it creates a squeeze point on the issue of state aid, which has been festering for a long time. This isn't new, but it creates this squeeze point. And so it sort of brings to a head the issue. Then you have the Labor leader in New South Wales, Heffron, decides to put state aid on his platform. But it is overridden by the federal Labor executive, the famous 36 faceless men, who say that that is not going to be the federal platform and it's not going to be Labor's platform at all. And so there's a walking back from it. Now, a lot of people argue that that was a catalyst, that Menzies said, right, state aid is an issue and that's where the election would focus and it would pull the Catholic vote into the Liberal Party. But I think, you know, we've discussed today a lot of the backstory around science education and the way in which the importance of science and the link with science and the national need and national defence was really bubbling along for a long time. And so I think, if anything, the 1963 election is not a state aid election. Maybe there was some opportunistic timing. But when you look at the 1964 legislation, it states grants science laboratories and technical training. And what it is providing money to the states to build science laboratories and to provide support for science education. It's not a broad-based act for state aid in general. It's very specific. And what Menzies does is basically say he's providing support for the building of science laboratories and providing equipment without discrimination. Now, if you go back to Robson and the Industrial Fund, as we've discussed, it's actually quite discriminatory. Boys, private schools.
Yes.
And there was complaint at the time, why aren't you putting these laboratories into girls' private schools? The answer was, well, if we had more money, we would then move to girls. But, you know, the whole system was discriminatory. And this is what Menzies said, without discrimination. Now, I think what that does is open the door to state aid and allows the push for state aid to move through this now narrow channel and, of course, change the way you see education funded. But the other thing I would quickly say about the 1963 election is that the vote changing that took place before the 63 election was not targeted to state aid as much as I would argue is targeted the fact that in November 1963, President Kennedy is assassinated.
Yeah.
And a week before the election. Now, without going into the way in which Kennedy was viewed, people were fearful about what that would mean And we know the Cuban Missile Crisis was thought to bring the world to the brink of nuclear war. People saw Kennedy as a stabilizing force in the Cold War. Once he's assassinated, there's this sense of being set adrift. And I think a very strong argument can be made that people voted in the 1963 election, not primarily as a state aid election, but as a response equally so to the death of Kennedy. Mm. And you can see that change in the polling. And so I think then it makes the 1963 election a very complex one indeed. And I think I would argue that what we now understand as the broader picture of state aid was something that came through the desire to support science education without discrimination.
Yeah. And it just so happens that the beneficiaries were largely Catholic schools.
At that time. But having said that, state schools did not have laboratories. It was a problem across the board. And one of the things that, if we go back to Harry Messel for a moment, one of the things that Harry Messel did when he invited teachers to come in for professional training, at the end of that, he surveyed them. 60 teachers responded. Mm-hmm. And he asked them, what was the state of play of science education in their schools? Well, this provides absolutely priceless information about what teaching was like. So 60 teachers responded. So they didn't have equipment. They didn't have rooms. If they had a chemistry room, it didn't have the right equipment or right conditions for teaching physics. If they had a physics room, they didn't have a sink and couldn't teach chemistry. They couldn't get chemicals to do practical work. If they wanted anything and they went to their head teacher or their principal, the answer was, if you want £7 worth of equipment, everybody's going to come to me and want £7 worth of something. They didn't have laboratory assistants. They were only sometimes 2 year trained and didn't have the knowledge. So these teachers provided pages and pages and pages of what we can now see as really useful historical information about the paucity of their work conditions to teach science. So although the Catholic schools might have been, as you say, the prime beneficiary, so were the state schools.
Yeah.
That were equally as poor in this space. So everybody benefited. And this is why I think the key phrase in this story is Menzies' statement that he was going to do it without discrimination. Mm. So, yes, Catholic kids benefited. So did girls who went to any school. And so did kids who went to state schools in any place. So it really was without discrimination.
I think it's worth reflecting on too, Jennifer, the level of sectarianism in Australia in the 1950s and 60s. I think it's hard for people in 2024 to imagine it because it's not really a feature of society these days. But can you tell me what it was like? I mean, Menzies even was criticised for attending the opening of a Catholic school in his own electorate by members of his own family. He was Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. He said, no, what are you doing going to Catholic schools and officiating there? And he said, well, I'm the member for Kooyong. I represent my entire electorate, not just people of certain religions. But it was pretty hard fought, that level of sectarianism back then, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a sectarian society. Mm. You had Catholic schools, you had public schools, you had other sorts of private schools, but they didn't interact at all. And there was deep prejudice against the Catholic population. They felt that they were held out of various jobs and offices, that people were labelled as to whether they were Catholic or Protestant. There's a lot of popular lore around how people behaved towards Catholics or Protestants one way or the other. So, yes, it was a highly sectarian society. And, in fact, it was one of the main features, I think, that defined Australian society in those days. So the state aid issue was highly fraught and very, very emotional. And I think if you look at some of the Catholic schools too, they had very high student numbers in the classes. They were very poor. They didn't have a lot of facilities at all. But yes, I think the sectarian debate is something that we really do have to take into account. And I think, yes, you're right. It was absolutely a feature of that era.
Why do you think it is that historians, when they do an analysis of that 63 election, and I mean, we should note that the 61 election was the election that Robert Menzies almost lost. In fact, yes. I think he only won just the required number of seats. And I think Arthur Calwell's Labor Party actually won the majority of the vote. So, you know, poor Arthur Calwell, three times he came up against Menzies and three times he lost, even when he did manage to, in 61, win the popular vote. But the narrative around the 63 election, which, you know, Menzies' government wins 10 more seats, they win a clear majority in Parliament, do really well. It's his last election he faces as Prime Minister. But the narrative is that it was won on the state aid issue. You're saying that can be debunked, that actually the investment was in science labs and science education, and that this was irrespective of whichever school it was. But we consistently see across all the sort of tellings of this history that it was just about this sectarian issue, and he was after the Catholic vote, and he was very kind of ruthless in his prosecution of a political campaign around a sectarian issue.
Yes, it is very interesting and it's very complex. And I don't think I would deny that state aid was an element to it. But Gorton was asked specifically about whether this bill was connected to the Catholic vote. He denied that it was. And Gorton was the man that Menzies put in to run this program, to become, well, there was no education minister in these days. Not until the late 60s. So John Gorton was put in as the person to organise what was a very complex program. And he denied it was about the Catholic vote. He agreed with this notion that it was about the science and it was about the education. But I think probably the problem is that what this does is open the floodgates to federal support of education. And it's because there is a clause that Menzies uses, which is that the federal government can provide money to the states if it's a tied grant. And this was a tied grant for science and science laboratories. So is this a loophole, or did he actually want to support science? I actually think that the history shows that Menzies was aware of the need for science and science education. He knew that he had to do this for the national interest. Perhaps the 1963 election and the Labor Party's decision around shifting their policy at that last minute provided that motive, that opportunity to come in and actually make the change. But I honestly don't think this piece of legislation was introduced simply and only to capture the Catholic vote. I think there's too much evidence to support a moving forward in science education and the need for it. And this is why I think it is important to look at what happens in America, because they do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
This is Western response to Sputnik, but also to the Cold War, to the way they see the West lining up with what's happening in the Soviet Union. It's a movement of several years. I think the state aid thing is an opportunity to go then, to affect the timing. But I just don't see it as totally a state aid bill.
Yeah,
because it is so specific and it's so narrow.
And there'd been too much work done in the lead up to just say that it was just about that sectarian issue, that it was, you know, been investigated and thought about. And obviously there'd been all the initiatives in New South Wales that had built up to this point. I wonder, Jennifer, if we could finish up with a bit more of a contemporary discussion, because it seems to me that with US-China tensions, for example, around competitiveness with AI and chip manufacturing, and then decoupling of the West and sort of China and its affiliated states over all these sort of technological aspects. You know, we have the 5G issue with Huawei and the like, that we're once again finding ourselves at a point where we do need our own homegrown talent. And we are once again looking at our own education system, not least at the higher education level, but particularly at the school's education level. And we're just not making the grade. We're falling in the rankings. Is there something that we can look at the lessons from our past to try and find an impetus to actually invest more heavily in these areas so we do have that pipeline of local talent, which we may very well need more and more if we do see that deep coupling between the US and its allies and China and its own allies?
I think it's a very good question, and I see a lot of parallels between what's happening now and what happened in the late 50s, early 60s. And I think there's a couple of things that come out of that. And one is that in 1957, Sputnik provided a catalyst to action. And I guess my question would be, what is the catalyst that we have here? Because what I see in a lot of the difficulties that you've outlined and the situation that you've just described, to me, sits like the history that we've been talking about. And then there's Sputnik. So it's like, what is it that's going to provide that impetus to actually pull all of these things together? And Sputnik did do that. Sputnik did not create the changes in education, but it helped focus the changes that were already undergoing discussion and had begun. So it helped to bring it together. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing is, I think what the 1950s, late 50s and 60s also showed is that they needed to look carefully at high achieving students and supporting them. And I think this was part of the debate then, that they would see that students who had an aptitude for high level maths or for science were not getting the support that they needed to actually develop, which is what Harry Messel did when he pulled students out into the university. They were the high-achieving students in the high schools, and he gave them information to stimulate their interest and to grow their interest in science. I should say the other thing he did, which I think was also extraordinary at the time, is those lectures that he gave those students were televised.
Oh, wow.
And so kids who could not attend, hadn't been chosen, could watch them on TV. And anybody could watch them on TV. And in fact, the Woman's Weekly did a report on these lectures and basically said to the women who read the Woman's Weekly that they were delivered in such a style, and I quote them here, that any bird-brained woman could understand them.
Well, there you go.
There you go. But what they did was they televised the lectures. So it was about publicity as well, providing that broad knowledge. So there's a couple of things there. What are we doing for high achieving students in the school system, even in the university system? What are we doing to actually provide that extra stimulation that high achieving students feed off and provide them with the opportunity to advance and to spark and to really move in the directions that we want them to go? How are we supporting them? What are we doing to actually advertise, promote, and facilitate greater knowledge about these higher level things or about science? Or in the case that we're talking about now, it's probably more around AI and creative computing, those sorts of things, cybersecurity. What are we doing to actually provide more knowledge about that in the sort of promotional space? So I think there are a lot of parallels. And I think there's not necessarily also the understanding that not every young person wants to go into science. But what we see in the legislation, that particularly in America, was it included all kinds of other things. It included languages. It included area studies. And they support the growth of an intellectual society, because what it's actually about is pursuing excellence. Harry Messel, his catchphrase was the pursuit of excellence. He didn't invent that. It was a phrase that came out of America at this time, because the science, the high-achieving students, the support for growth and development was about pursuing excellence. And so I think all of these things are good lessons for us, because we are facing similar difficulties at the moment, but we need to look back to this era to see how they dealt with it, the importance of leadership. Where is the leadership in the universities? Where is the leadership in curriculum development? Where is the leadership from industry? Where is the leadership in government? I mean, those things all came together in this period. So I think you're absolutely right to ask the question. There are many similarities. We have in this period answers to some of those problems. And I think at the moment we're falling short on delivering on some of those answers for our time and in our circumstances.
And I guess, Jennifer, the final question is, where is Sputnik? Maybe we're just waiting for the next one. Jennifer Clark, thank you so much for joining me on Afternoon Light. It's been an absolute pleasure. I hope lots of policymakers are listening to this and drawing on all these lessons of history to really create a next generation of high-achieving students who are after that pursuit of excellence. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this week's episode of Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute. Please make sure to subscribe and catch up on our latest online content on our website or on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook.